First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the BS Report special NBA Finals edition for you. Today we have Jay Adonde from ESPN.com, and around the horn he's going to talk Celtic Lakers and growing up with it. But first, from ABC, the host of Jimmy Kimmel Live, my old boss, let's bring him on, Jimmy Kimmel.
Thank you for that intro, Bill. I love getting introduced.
What's happening? You're kind of like a central figure in these 2008 finals. You have the show.
Am
coming
I really?
On before each one. Yeah. I don't know if you know this. Your show
Where
is on right
I
before.
Rank? I mean, obviously I'm not up with Kobe and Paul Pierce, but what players do you think I would rank among as far as the central figure part goes?
I think you're right there with Sasha Vujicic.
Thank you.
You're an agitator.
He's a handsome devil, isn't he?
He really is. You know, Carolla, I have Carolla all excited because I always say Sasha was the lost villain from Cliffhanger who wasn't in John Lithgow's crew. Carolla loves that. And then that leads to a 15-minute Carolla Cliffhanger rant.
Oh, yeah. At least 15 minutes.
So how are you doing your shows and doing these pregame shows?
I really don't know. You know, I give 110% every night. And,
you really do.
What we do is we tape portions of them when we can, and we do stuff that day when we have to, and we piece it all together. And then do the regular show on top of it.
Now, last night, before Game 3 in the East Coast, after Game 3 in the West Coast, you sent your Aunt Chippy to a casino in California that I had never heard of, but somehow had a decent-looking dealer, which I was proud of you for finding. And you've done this blackjack thing a couple times with Cousin Sal, and it's always turned out miserably. This time, she was betting $10,000 a hand, won the first two, and then got blackjack on the third. It almost looked rigged.
And no, it did. But the truth is, if we were going to rig something, we would not make it look so rigged.
Right.
You know, it would be too blatant to do it like that. I think we've done it like five or six times now, and the audience always loses. And the idea is the audience gets split money, so they go crazy.
So how did you figure out, like, okay, $100,000, so what happened? Each audience member had to, like, fill out paperwork?
Yeah, and the ones who are foreigners don't get it, and if you're not over 21, you're not eligible. So I think about half of the audience wound up getting a piece, which meant they got almost $1,000 each.
And also, most of the Lakers didn't get a piece because none of them are from here.
How dare you?
Well, they are. They're all foreigners. Wait a second. So you're telling me you're actually rooting for the Lakers in this series?
As you know, yes, I am rooting for the Lakers.
But you're not a Lakers fan. You don't care.
How can you say that?
You're not a Lakers fan. You don't care. I will say that.
Well, that's a preposterous thing to say. I mean, I've been a Lakers fan since I was a kid, since I was a child.
Do you have a Lakers flag on your Rolls Royce?
No, I don't even have a Rolls Royce, but I've been a Lakers. You know what? I can even show you pictures to prove that I'm a Lakers fan if you're skeptical. I don't understand why people, you know, I grew up in Las Vegas. The Lakers were our local team. And, in fact, I saw Larry Bird and Magic Johnson play in this Pizza Hut college all-star game in Las Vegas. And I fell in love with Magic Johnson there, and I followed him as soon as he got to the Lakers.
I hope you didn't really fall in love with him.
I did, in a way, yes.
that in a way that became physical.
No.
If Las Vegas, you know, you're from Las Vegas, so you should know the answer to this question.
Okay.
How did Las Vegas figure prominently in Laker history?
Well, Kareem broke the all-time scoring record there.
Okay, that's one. There's one other way. It's
well,
a tough
that's
one.
A pretty huge way, by the way.
I know, but here's another. There's another. It's a two-part thing.
Let me just say, whatever number two is secondary to Kareem breaking the all-time scoring record there. But I'll try to.
I'll give you the year, 1992.
Okay, Las Vegas.
It's a little-known thing.
Oh well. Well, let's see. The Jazz played half of their season there.
No, after
Not
the Rodney
that year.
King,
what?
The Rodney King riots happened in the playoffs, and they had to move The Rodney King riots actually happened during one of the Lakers' home playoff games. They had to move the next game to Las Vegas.
Oh, to the Thomas and Mack.
Remember that?
Oh, yeah, that's right. You know what? It's I was out stealing TVs at that time.
So I
may have been a little distracted.
Yeah, that was a lucrative riot for you.
Oh, yeah, that's where I got all 17 of my TVs. People think, oh, boy, this guy's really spending money. I got them all for free.
You weren't in L.A. when the riots happened, were you?
No, I was in, what year did you say it was?
I'm going to say that was 92.
Yeah. Boy, I thought it was later than that. I thought it was here, but I think I may have been living in Palm Springs at the time.
Well, let me ask you how your life has changed since you became the king of viral video, which I don't call you, and you hate that. You don't like to be called the king of viral video, but you know what? I'm not going to apologize.
I don't hate it. I mean, I like being called king of something, but I was hoping the word viral wouldn't be in there in my
title. Well, you
title.
Had these two videos that it combined like 35 million hits or something. All of a sudden, you're in Us Weekly constantly, which I always take as a sign of real fame.
Me and the girls from the hills.
Yeah, I mean, as I've told you, when you're taking out your trash and somebody takes a picture of this and you end up in a magazine taking out your trash, you've become famous.
I told you my good paparazzi experience, right?
What was it?
When I pulled over, I was on La Brea, no, I was on La Cienega, and these people, this woman and her child, were their car had broken down. It was in the middle of the street, so I got out of the car and I pushed their car, you know, to a parking spot, and then gave them a ride to the gas station. We came back and got gas and everything. As I'm pushing the car, I look up, and there's a paparazzi photographer taking my picture. I was like, finally, this is exactly what you want. You know, you look like
right.
a real hero.
Good Samaritan.
Yeah, and then I wound up in the They're Just Like Us category.
Now, there's a flip side to this coin. You also don't want to be the guy who stumbles out of some club or stumbles out of some restaurant with the TMZ video photographer filming you as it happens.
There's nothing you can do about it. Did you see Lasorda's video today on TMZ?
I did not. How was it?
Lasorda comes out of, I think he was at Mastro's or something, this nice restaurant, and he comes out, and you would think that he's never even heard of paparazzi before, because he comes out like, what the hell is this? And, right. you know, he's looking around, he's got a disgusted look on his face, like, what the hell are you people all doing here? And they're surrounding him and shooting him, and people are trying to take pictures, and he's getting agitated. And then the best part is, as he's getting into his car, one of the paparazzi guys says, do you have any advice for Nicole Richie's baby? And Douglas sort of goes, what's that? He goes, Nicole Richie's baby. He's like, who's Nicole Richie? And the guy goes, you don't know who Nicole Richie is? No. He's like, well, she just had a baby. He's like, oh, well, congratulations. I can't think of a worse question to ask Tommy Lasorda than, do you have any advice for Nicole Richie's baby?
Or a more delightful question. What was it, our first year of the show when he was second? Remember that? He was second behind some, I want to say it was an athlete or a singer or somebody. And he
was
outraged that he was the second
guest. I don't remember who the first guest was.
I don't either.
We talked, you know, we had like an 8-minute interview, you know, normal length, maybe even a little longer than usual. And then we had a guy on the show who he was just a human interest guest. His thing was, he's eaten two Big Macs every day for the last like 35 years of his
that's
life.
That's right.
And that's all he'd ever eaten. And, you know, I talked to Tommy and we talked about baseball and the Olympics and all that stuff. And then we get on and we bring this guy out and he's weird looking and Tommy's disgusted immediately. And then Tommy realizes that the reason the guy's out there so I could talk to him about eating Big Macs every day. And Tommy is furious. He's absolutely furious at me for putting this guy on when I could have been talking to him. So after the show, Tommy wants to speak to me in the dressing room. And I went in the dressing room and he yelled at me, and you know this is not an exaggeration, he yelled at me for 43 minutes straight.
I was going to say 45.
Video of that. I mean, there was a certain point where he kept yelling at me over and over again. He kept kind of repeating the same thing over and over again in a loop, and I kept apologizing. And then there was a point where I started looking around the room for hidden cameras, thinking that he was pulling a bit on me. I even looked at him like, oh, you, and I look around, and I'm trying to find the hidden cameras, and I didn't find them.
No, he paraded
you. I wish you were there, though. I really do. It was one of the great. I really felt like a big leaguer.
I actually caught a little of it in the first 15 minutes and then came back for seconds at about like the 33-minute mark. as he still berated you.
It was really bad.
I don't know what made him the maddest, the fact that he was the second guest and not the first guest, or that he had to sit there and listen to the hamburger guy.
And then we had a comedian who came on and was slamming President Bush, which Tommy didn't care for. It really was unpleasant. But we've made amends. In fact, I think he forgot about it almost immediately.
Oh, probably as he was walking out of the theater. Yeah, I wish, you know, as I said, my biggest regret is not keeping a journal or something for all those stories.
I mean, how many times do you, if you think about it, like, how many times do you really yell at someone in your life?
Right. Berate
like, how
them?
Often
Never.
Does it happen? Like, maybe
Never.
Once every 6 months?
For me, it was just the guys from DirecTV. Who I am becoming convinced now is DirecTV is the most evil operation.
What? Not a, what are you, crazy?
They're the least helpful, most annoying. They contradict each other. They send out separate orders. You end up paying. I'm not kidding you. Me and my wife have spent probably 12 hours on the phone with DirecTV in the past 2 weeks.
Well, I don't know what's going on at your house, but at my house, it's one of the most beautiful things. It's even better than a rainbow.
That's because you grease the guys when they come. Maybe
but
I should do that.
Tommy Lasorda yells at people. I mean, you know, during baseball, you know, he was a manager. He was yelling constantly. It's part of his everyday.
Right.
And I think once you retire, it's hard to give that up.
Well,
and
also,
you just keep yelling at people all the time.
He's also one of those guys that is not as famous as he used to be, but he doesn't realize it yet. Like he's Tommy Lasorda in 1978, this colossal sports figure of the time. Now it's 2008, and there's maybe a lot of people under 35 don't totally know who he is.
Yeah, but I don't think he wants to talk to those people anyway. I mean, he's still Tommy Lasorda.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
It's true. I mean, he's definitely a big celebrity out here.
Yes.
I think if he walks around in Boston or New York or Chicago.
I don't know. I bet you he's big out there too, especially if he's walking around in the Dodger uniform.
By the way, Tommy's not going to listen to this podcast. You don't have to play devil's advocate with me in case he's hearing. Yeah,
no, I wouldn't do that. I think Tommy Lasorda is one of those guys. I actually asked Magic, you know, how people react to him when he is in Boston. You know, because I wonder if people are, you know, if they still hate him or razz him or whatever. And he says people are excited to see him and they love him.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah, I think people remember that era so fondly.
But yeah. People love him from his talk show, too.
That was it. Now that that's on YouTube, I think he's brought it a whole new generation. Really, the only Laker that Boston fans continue to despise is Kareem.
Why do people? I don't think Lakers fans really like Kareem that much either.
I think he, you know, as I've written many times, he was a ninny. I think that's the first thing. But also, he was one of those guys that he was really. It's kind of enigmatic, kind of tough to like. Really, like when he was in Airplane was really the only time you ever really would have gone out of your way to like Kareem.
Yeah.
But in Boston, he whistled an elbow at Larry Legend's head in Game 4 of the Finals in 84. Nobody's forgotten that.
Well, I, of course, always liked Kareem. But I do think my favorite Kareem moment probably was when Kareem, who is a Muslim, and, you know, some of the tenets of being a Muslim is you do not drink alcohol, you do not eat pork, was doing a Coors commercial. I got a kick out of that.
That's pretty funny. So what is your prediction for the Lakers Celtics?
I still think the Lakers are going to win. I really do. I mean, you know, people have been, you know, we've been doing these primetime shows, so people are throwing all sorts of scenarios around. Like, okay, well, if there is a game, it's going to be fine. It's, you know, I think the Lakers are going to pull it out. And I bet on it, too, a lot.
Well, anytime you bet on something, it usually goes the other way. So that makes me feel good.
That's
the Lakers,
not true. That's not
Lakers,
true at all.
Oh, it's true. The Lakers would have to win the title in Boston.
What's
no,
that?
The Lakers would have to win the title in Boston. You realize that?
Yeah, I know. It's going to be all the sweeter. It's going to be wonderful.
No, not for me.
I can't wait. I really can't.
Give me your quick thoughts on Kobe Bryant, because you have...
Let me ask you, who do you think is going to win the series?
I actually think the Celtics are going to win in six.
Now you do?
I picked seven, but I didn't expect them to win the first two games.
Well, you picked the Lakers to win to start with.
No, I was doing a stupid reverse jinx thing, and I had to abandon
That's
it.
That's very convenient, Simmons, by the way, because no matter how it turns out, you can claim you were right.
No. I was on the record Celtics in seven.
Mm-hmm.
The reverse jinx, it was not working that well for me.
What was the other question?
The Kobe question.
Yeah.
Kobe question.
Yes.
You've dealt with him a few times behind the scenes. Give us your thoughts on such a complicated sports figure.
Well, I've met him a few times. One time was at the American Music Awards or some award show that I was on, and I met him backstage, and he was very nice to me. It was terrible because I had some horrible jokes directed at him, and it's always the worst when you run into somebody just before you're about to assassinate them, and
right.
then they're nice, and then you feel bad about the whole thing, but what are you going to do, you know? So I went out there, and moments after shaking his hand and smiling at him, I was staring at him and his wife in his seat and said something terrible. I don't even remember what it was, but it was a long time before I saw him again after that.
I think it was a diamond ring joke, because I was with you for those American Music Awards.
It may have been something about that gigantic ring.
Yeah, I remember running into him and both of us being appalled afterwards that you had to make a joke about him like 10 seconds later.
Yeah, and I think we then hid afterwards probably. And then he's been on the show, and he was actually very nice. I mean, he was, you know, you can't get a sense of anyone in the half hour they're at a talk show, really. I mean, you can get maybe just a lead on it, but you can't really judge somebody based on anything like that. But he's unbelievable. He's an unbelievable player. And I mean, I think there's a really good chance we will look back and he will replace Michael Jordan as the greatest player of all time. I mean, I'm not saying it's going to happen, but I think it could.
Bite your tongue.
I often do.
How dare you blaspheme MJ? I will say that I remember when Kobe came on your show, and I do get the sense with him that he's got little switches depending on the circumstances. And I really wonder what he's like just to, like, you know, watch Roadhouse with at 8 o'clock on a Sunday night. Like what it's like when all the guards come down and he's just the person he is. Because on the talk show, you could see he's like trying to be funny Kobe, and he's got his little couple stories he sets up for you that he knows he's going to tell. And
that's no different than anybody else that comes on a talk show.
Well, but you have actors and actresses that mostly come on your show. And my point is, he's kind of reminded me of those people. They have their little couple stories, and you have athletes come on your show, mm-hmm. and they're kind of rolling with your punches. They don't know what's going to happen. They trust you, and they just kind of, you take them in the directions that you want them to go. With him, it seemed like he was kind of controlling it a little bit. Does that make sense?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if that's the case, but you know, the stature of the athlete. I mean, there's a difference if it's Kobe Bryant or Kimbo Slice. You know, I mean, that does definitely, as far as the tone goes. I mean, if Michael Jordan was on the show, you're very respectful, you know. I mean, that's just how it is. And, you know, he's Kobe Bryant.
Who's the guest you've been the most kind of intimidated? I don't want to say intimidated, but, you know, like kind of the most cautious with because of how either famous they were or the demeanor that they gave off.
Oh, Tyson, definitely.
Oh, that's
the impression. There was a moment of sheer terror during the, which I never had before or since.
Right.
During the thing where where Mike Tyson was singing karaoke, and who was it, Allie Landry was
right.
on the show.
He decided he liked her.
He was so smitten with her that I honestly, at a certain point, I was so worried that I looked around and I picked up the telephone on my desk to see how heavy it was, just in case I had to use something to hit him over the head with.
Yeah, that was great. I don't, you know, Tyson now, I don't feel like he's like that anymore.
No, I don't think so either. And I think, I have a theory about Tyson, which could be totally wrong, but I think that Tyson is a person that, like a lot of people, needs to be on antidepressants. You know, I don't know if he's bipolar, I don't know what it is, but I think that he's not a great fighter when he's in a good frame of mind, and I think that the people who handled him would take him off that medication before a fight.
Because to make him more violent.
No other explanation for biting not just one ear, but to me, the most remarkable thing was, I mean, I could see maybe you bite somebody's ear off in a fight, but the second time you bite that person's ear off.
To go back for seconds?
That's where it's over the line for me. You know, first time is maybe your head's right there and, you know, your teeth, your neck, you just like bite into it. But then when you do it again, that to me is too much.
It's a very good point. Well, listen, congrats on everything that's happened with the show. I'm very proud of you.
Thank you so much.
Keep up the good work, and I'll see you soon.
All right. Take care.
All right. Thanks.
Bye.
Let's bring him on. Jay Adonde. How you doing, buddy?
Good, Bill. How's it going?
We're natural enemies of the wild this week.
We have to pull. We shouldn't be speaking to each other. We should have been separated last night at the game.
I know, but you know what? I thought we handled ourselves with a lot of dignity and class during game three. For the people who are listening to this maybe on a Thursday or Friday, but tell me what your emotions are as we delve midway through this Lakers-Celtics nostalgic finals.
It's very weird. I mean, first, just I'm definitely filled with nostalgia, just seeing those green and gold jerseys on the court.
Yeah.
You know, I definitely bought into all the hype running up, you know, watching the games. Well, watching what I could on Classic. I can't watch 84 still. That's probably the most painful sports memory still. Is 1984 series, to have my favorite player, Magic Johnson, go down in flames in Game 7, to have James Worthy throw the ball away
in
Game 2 to Henderson. They showed that clip in Boston the other night, and I had to turn my head. I just cannot watch that. That's the most painful moment of my childhood. It was a traumatic experience. 1984 still haunts me.
You know what's funny? I was on the Sports Illustrated Vault, that site they have, which is really cool. And I forgot, somebody wrote a column during the summer about how unclutch Magic Johnson was.
In that series, definitely.
Yeah, it was written like 2 months after the finals, and it was more like an overview, like how are we going to remember this guy going forward? And, you know, you and I remember this because we're NBA junkies, but I don't think people really understand how colossally he choked in that series and then how it eventually shaped him to become the player he became.
And it's funny because that's like, after that, it's kind of like Ben after his daughter died, that look that he had on Lost.
Yeah,
you
know, yeah.
He was just vengeful Ben. Magic, if you watch him in the 84, if you can tolerate watching both 84 and 85, like me, I can only watch 85. But if you can watch him in 85, there's no smiling, there's no joking, no high-fiving. He was just on a mission to redeem himself. I mean, obviously, he did rebound from that 84 disaster, won two out of the next three championships, started picking up MVP. I'm sorry, three of the next four championships, started picking up MVPs. But, you know, it all changed after 84. And he was talking about that recently. He went into a funk. He just basically didn't talk to anybody.
Yeah.
You know, he kind of hid in his room. I used to go to his summer basketball camp. I went 81 and 84 was the last year I went. And he was so mean that year in 84. Like, like somebody made a peep and he took away our playground access, took away our swimming pool privileges. I mean, it was just all work that summer. He
took away the teenage hookers. Well, I don't think he really fully became the Magic who was the killer of the second half of his career until 87. Because in 85, he did have a good series, but he did get to ride the back of Kareem, who submitted one of the all-time vintage Kareem performances those last five games. 87 was when he really ripped Boston's heart out.
Yeah, that was when the team became his. You know, Riley made it official. And you're right. He still kind of deferred to Kareem in the mid-80s, but by 87 is when he had taken over. But he still had that look of a guy on a mission. And before we leave 84, the thing that makes me mad is that Magic's unclutchness overshadowed McHale's unclutchness.
Oh, yeah.
Remember, what preceded the Worthy pass was intercepted by Henderson? McHale missing free throws. And McHale missed free throws before Magic missed free throws in Game 4 out here in L.A., too.
Well,
McHale
would
have been the GOAT.
Well, not just that, but he missed the second free throw in Game 2. They showed this during Larry Bird night. They slowed it down. His knees actually shook as he released the ball. You could see them, like, fluttering. And then nobody remembers this. Wait, you know, the greatest basketball game, in my opinion, ever, Game 4 of the 84 Finals. Bird just misses by, like, you know, a fingernail, the game-winning shot. McHale gets the rebound over his head, little four-footer, missed it.
Yep,
if they lose that game, he is, as you said, the GOAT of the series, and maybe his career unfolds differently.
And he's the one guy, now if we can flash forward, like the new versions of Lost, flash forward to today, I never would have imagined that, you know, I can talk to Danny Ainge and enjoy the process. You know, I mean, he's a guy I used to want to smack when I was growing up watching Lakers-Celtics.
Right.
Dennis Johnson, before he passed away, was really one of the people I really liked in the NBA. You know, he was assistant and then temporarily head coach with the Clippers. I even told him one time, I said, DJ, man, I used to hate you. He just kind of smiled and laughed. But, yeah, I mean, Dennis was a great guy, and as you argued, worthy of being in the Hall of Fame. Maxwell, I was joking around with Cornbread Maxwell in the game and before the game in Boston, before Game 2. So, I mean, all these guys who, you know, I just despised growing up, I've come to like and tolerate, and I never would have imagined that. But McHale is the one who I still don't like. He's really arrogant and not helpful at all to members of the media, so I still dislike him. I still root against him in the when I watch those old games.
Especially after he gave the Celtics Garnett. You know, what's interesting about the mid-80s was how many characters there were that ended up becoming more than just the figures in that game. Like, you look at a lot of the people on both teams, they became assistant coaches, GMs, broadcasters. You know, I wonder, like, when you look at that, when you compare this 2008 finals versus 84 or 85 or 87, like, I really wonder how many of these guys we'll even see 20 years from now.
You don't think Sasha Vujicic or Ronnie Turioff are going to be running teams? Is that what you're saying?
I think we'll see Sasha in some Hollywood thrillers. I still think.
Or the other side of the mountain.
Well, I think Cliffhanger 3, I think he could be the lead henchman, something like that. He was in rare form in Game 3.
He was great in that game.
As well as he can play, and he was also agitating the Celts and picking them up with pressure defense. Do you feel, I just said in a column, I was saying that I feel like this series is going to start to get going on Thursday night. Like, the first three games, you got the weird start times, you got people are nervous, they're feeling each other out. By the second half of Game 3, I thought that was the best, you know, the most competitive, highest quality of play we've seen out of these first three games. Would you agree?
To a degree. I mean, you still didn't have great play from Pierce or from Garnett.
No.
You know, we still haven't seen either team really at their best. I think the Lakers' best can beat the Celtics' best, but I don't think the Celtics are going to allow the Lakers to be at their best. They've done such a good job of taking them out. And I don't know at this point, three games in, if Lamar Odom and Pau Gasol are ever really going to show up. You know, Pau had a good start to game two, you know, but was pretty quiet again throughout game three. Lamar, I don't know what's going on with him. Derek Fisher has been a non-factor. Nobody's really talking about
that. Hold on. What do you mean you don't know what's going on with Lamar?
you
can't say that. Come on. You got a national audience listening. You know what's going on with Lamar. You watched him in the Clippers.
Yeah, but not this bad. I mean, to just, you know, have no idea what he's doing out there.
Are you surprised, though? You can't honestly tell me that you're shocked that Lamar Odom has played that badly.
I keep wanting to believe in Lamar because, you know, you want to root for this guy. He's overcome so much just to get here. You know,
I'm with you.
Personal loss and tragedy. But you know what I kind of like about this series, and it is so different from the 80s, is that all these guys are flawed. You know, I mean, Kevin Garnett just has that thing where he can't do it in the fourth quarter. You know, Paul Pierce has had his shaky moments. You know, Ray Allen's really been the most consistent guy. He was the guy that was criticized by a lot of people, even when they made the deal.
Including me.
He's been the most consistent Celtic, both ends of the floor. But, you know, Sasha Vujicic, Pau Gasol, the softness, Lamar Odom. That's kind of the interesting thing to me in this series is the flaws and who will overcome their flaws to get the championship. You know, you're not seeing two great teams clash like you did in the 80s. You're seeing two flawed teams. And it's funny, one former great who's been around said, you know, he thinks this Laker team is really one of the worst finals teams he's seen in a while, which is surprising because I thought the Lakers looked pretty good throughout the playoffs.
Well, you with the flaws, you left out Kobe as a teammate.
Yeah, Kobe and just his personal, you know, this great guy who will never fully be accepted by the basketball world. You know, his greatest flaw is the fact that he's not Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. I was thinking, and Kobe, there's deservedly, he brings a lot of the criticism on himself for the things, because of the things he does. But there's some stuff that is unfair. I was thinking if Michael Jordan, you know, Michael, one of the great games we canonize him for is that 63 points in Boston Garden. Well, they lost that game. If Kobe scores 63 and they lose, can you imagine how much he'd be killed? So, I mean, that's some of the things that's unfair with Kobe. But part of it is the flaw that he's never understood basically how to deal with people, how to incorporate people. And as a result, he doesn't get that same treatment that Michael has.
Yeah, but at the same time, you were there in Boston for Game 1 and Game 2. I mean, I would describe his demeanor in those games as semi-poisonous.
Well, especially Game 2.
Yeah.
It wasn't quite as obvious to me in Game 1. Game 1, I was sitting up at the very top for the first half. And then the second half, I moved down. We were the seats about 20 rows behind the baseline. And the good and bad thing about those is you're right in the middle of the fans, and so they were standing up. To their credit, you know, I'm not going to tell guys to sit down. They paid for the tickets. They're fans of their team. But they kept standing up, so it was kind of hard to see what was going on.
Right.
Game 2, I had a better angle, and I could really see, maybe not to the detail that Curt Schilling was able to see and block about, but I could see that disconnect that Kobe had from his teammates and his disgust over every slight, you know, mistake that they made. And you know, he went out and sat on the bench. And I think part of the look you saw on his face when he was on the bench was he was frustrated at the fouls that were called on him. But I think part of it was that frustration that here he is in the finals. He brought this team back to the finals, and so many guys are just failing to live up to the moment. I think he's in disbelief, but he's really angry, too, that, hey, guys, I'm doing my part. You know, I got you here. I believed in you all year, and now I show up, and this is what you do for me. Thanks a lot. You know, see if I'm going to pass you the ball at all for the next 365 days.
Well, yeah, you're right. He seems frustrated and he seems angry. And I can't really remember another superstar at this big of a stage who's kind of acted like that. But at the same time, I was thinking about it. When you think about what MJ did in, you know, the late 90s before they finally got over the Detroit hump. And I remember game 7 of that Detroit series, the one when Pippen had the migraine. And Jordan basically did all the same things.
Yeah, and again, frustrated. Didn't face the criticism for it. We've seen some of these very same looks from Michael. I mean, we've seen him clash with teammates after they won the championship. I remember I went out to media day, and Michael shows up late, and there's all the speculation if he was even going to be there, and Horace Grant was spouting off about how, you know, Michael's going to separate himself from the team. That's not how we won the championship. I want to keep winning championships. We're not going to do it if Michael's going to act this way. Michael finally shows up, tries to assure everybody that it's all okay, and then he goes behind a closed door with Horace Grant. There's a window, though, so you can see them arguing in there.
Right.
The story is that he threw a chair in that room, too. You know, so they go at it. And this is for a team that's the defending champion and hasn't even played a game yet in the next season. So Michael certainly had his clashes with his teammates. Of course, he famously punched Steve Kerr during practice when they had a disagreement. But yet he's not known for that. And part of the reason is, I guess, he didn't have athletes doing blogs back then like you do now.
Well, they did, and that's when Sam Smith's Jordan rules came out. It was such a big deal. Everybody's like, oh, my God, Jordan, like, said bad things to his teammates? Like, that was, like, such a huge deal at the time. And now you think, like,
you'd get that on a daily basis. Oh, today. You know, every little practice, every little misstep you made in practice would be blogged about.
And I think some of the stuff maybe he did off the court would also be blogged about. I don't think people would
show up on the dirty.com.
Yeah, I think he would be in some trouble with some of the more nefarious blogs. But I do think the one difference between Jordan and Kobe is that Jordan's teammates seem to be somewhat terrified of Jordan, but in a good way. Like, it made them play better. Like, they didn't want to disappoint him. Whereas with Kobe, it seems like sometimes he just kind of sucks the life out of his teammates. And I think that's something, you know, that definitely was the case in 2004, 2005, 2006. He's gotten better with it, but you could still kind of see it coming out in Boston. Last night it didn't matter as much, but I'll be interested to see in game 4 and game 5 if the Celts take a lead, they're up 10, guys are missing, like how they're going to react to that.
Well, you don't get the sense that they're playing for him.
Right.
You know, that you definitely had that with Magic and Bird, not just Jordan. You know, they're playing for those guys. You know, and I'd argue at the start of the season they were kind of playing in spite of him. You know, Kobe was really disconnected. People forget now. Everybody's, you know, kind of enthralled with the MVP season they had. But I'd say, you know, training camp and the early games in November, December, he was kind of disconnected from the team. And then they played so well, and Bynum progressed, and Jordan Farmer and Vujicic made improvements. So Kobe bought into it, and he said, okay, you know, these guys are playing hard. They've earned my respect. They've earned my trust. Now I'm going to join the party and play for them. And I thought it was telling the game after Bynum went down there in Seattle, and Kobe had one of those games where he just took over. They went in overtime, and Kobe, you know, scored all the points in overtime. And it was significant because it showed that he cared enough about this team to bail them out and to win the game for them. And from that point on, I think he was fully invested and bought into the team. But the guys, they kind of came out with the mindset, you know, we're going to play with or without you this year. And then once Kobe saw what was going on, he joined the party and, of course, you know, led them to the best record in the Western Conference.
I would even argue that they were in FU mode the first month of the season. Kind of like, really? You don't like us? Well, watch this. And they played kind of above their heads, a lot of them, especially Bynum.
Yeah. Well,
nobody saw that coming from Bynum. He should show flashes
and,
of
you know,
it.
He faced a lot of criticism. You know, and now the question is going to be whether, okay, did he do that because of Kobe? You know, did Kobe inspire him? That's a little bit of the revisionist history. You know, did he do it in spite of Kobe? Did he do it to shut Kobe up, which in case, you know, Kobe got the desired effect? I don't think that the best way to go about it is to, you know, criticize your teammates on TV and radio and in parking lots. But, you know, the thing about the NBA is the remarkable ability to forgive and forget.
Yeah.
You know, all these guys put everything behind them and were able to, you know, play very well on the court and come together as a unit on the court. And could you imagine going to work with somebody who, you know, basically trashed you on national radio and getting along and coexisting with them? But they do it. They do it on a constant basis in the NBA.
Well, and you also have to go back, not to keep tying MJ and Kobe together, but in the late 80s and the early 90s, you know, MJ really kind of destroyed a couple guys' careers. Like, I think it ruined Brad Sellers' career. Ruined Stacey King. Roddy McRae. Stacey, Dennis Hopson. Stacey King, when he showed up, you know, was kind of the low post scorer they should have had. He never panned out. I think
they really couldn't bring in any two guards, because any two guard they try to bring in, Michael would just destroy him in practice and they'd be a broken player. So they learned not to even bother to bring in two guards to try him out, because Michael would just go at him.
And even B.J. Armstrong, who really did develop into a nice little point guard, after a while, but he's had some really interesting stuff to say about Jordan, just how much Jordan was in his head those first couple years, and how he just didn't want to disappoint him, and finally he started playing better and stuff. But
they really didn't come together until that 93 season. Even at the start of the 92-93 season, that was the first year they put B.J. into the starting lineup. And Jordan was a little unhappy. He thought B.J. was shooting a little too much for a guy of his stature. And, he was griping a little bit. But then by the end of the season, he just, loved B.J.'s game. And then remember, when Jordan's father was killed, B.J. was down there.
Yep.
He was one of the guys you saw walking out of the house. So, he flew right there to be by Michael's side at, the darkest time of Michael's life. So that really all came together in the 92-93 season. You know what's weird, though? I saw B.J. and Michael last year in Vegas. Michael's playing in Trent Tucker's poker tournament at the Hard Rock at All-Star Weekend. And me, Mike Wilbon, Rick Bucher came over. We're talking to Michael. It was a great time. We had like an hour with Michael just sitting there by that middle lobby bar in the Hard Rock. And at one point, B. Johnson came over, and they just, these guys have been through battles together, won championships together, and they just kind of said, hey, what's up? How you doing? Talked for like a minute. And then BJ left and Michael's back to talking to us. And it just seemed really strange to me. Mm. And I just think maybe in the NBA you're with these guys so much and so long that you really have no need to see them again for the rest of your lives after you're done. If you look at all these legends that you see walking around, even the old Celtic greats, like, Cousy and Havlicek don't sit together at the games, right? I mean, they're just kind of all off doing their own separate things.
But maybe it's like college, where when you're in college, you're hanging with 11, 12 guys, and you think, I'm going to see these guys the rest of my life, and then 15 years later, you're down to like the four guys you talked to.
Yeah, I went back to my 10-year college reunion, and I remember seeing, fortunately, that was almost 10 years ago now, 6 years ago. You realize the only reason I talk to these people is we happen to be at the same place at the same time. But you take us out of, sharing the same classrooms and the same dorms, and we really have nothing to talk about.
Yeah.
It was kind of sad, and I don't think I'll go back to another college reunion, because I realize, the people I want to and need to stay in touch with, I have. I really don't have any need to see any of those people again.
See, I would disagree. I think you have to go back because you've been on TV so much that you'll probably bag the best-looking girl there.
Yeah, but
so
also
I would say
the last chance to really do that is the 10-year, I think, because that's the last
time. You get divorced people at the 20.
Yeah,
get the divorcees.
They're up in that cougar range. They're probably not even looking for somebody like me. they're in the cougar range. They're probably looking for somebody younger. So I realize that. The 10-year is really the last time you really want to make up for whatever you missed out on in college and kind of go back and relive that glory.
My buddy Jim Grady is saying about divorced women.
What's that?
That means they're on the go team. Forget my drift. it means they've worked out all the kinks.
Yeah, they're definitely
there's no Donna Martins who are divorcees.
Did all the inhibition, all that.
So you grew up in Santa Monica.
Morning,
you grew up in Santa Monica, right?
Yes, sir.
Diehard Laker fan your entire life. You work for the LA Times, or get a job at the LA Times. Now you have to write about the Lakers. What was that like? How do you turn that on-off switch with being a Laker fan versus writing objectively? Because I can't do it with the Celtics.
Well, it really wasn't that hard, because it started in college writing for the school paper. I mean, I think there's an even stronger bond with your college teams and want to see them do well than the pro teams you grow up rooting for. And I still, kind of feel that stronger bond for watching my school than watching the teams in L.A. I grew up with. But
which school was it?
I went to Northwestern, so I didn't see a lot of victories.
No.
There weren't classic battles like there were with the Lakers and the Celtics in the 80s. But really what it was is not about me. It's about the fans, and it's about trying to give the most honest assessment to the fans. And it's funny because I think the fans, and I got criticized for it at the Times and still at ESPN.com. The Laker fans say, we want to hear you say good things about the team. They want they're really conflicted because they want you to rip Phil for not calling the timeout. But then, if you criticize the team, they say you should be more supportive of the team. And I said, I always compare the job of the columnist like the weatherman. And, I could tell you it's going to be sunny all week, but does that really serve you? Don't you want to know if you should buy an umbrella and because it's supposed to rain on Tuesday? So you might not like the news that I'm delivering, but, this is what I'm seeing. And more importantly, this is what I'm hearing. And, the year I did nothing but the Lakers in 2003-04, because that was such a momentous season with Peyton and Malone on the team and Kobe Bryant facing his sexual assault allegations. So there's so much going on with that team. They signed me to the Lakers full-time in that season. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on with Kobe, and it was all coming from the locker room. You know, I wasn't making the stuff up, but people didn't want to hear it. And it's kind of interesting. And I just feel like my loyalty was to the truth and not Paul Pierce. I'm talking about the truth. my loyalty was to the truth and not necessarily to what people wanted to hear. And, you know, I thought that team, you know, I picked them to beat Detroit in the finals, you know, for all the stuff they're going on, but they had a lot of stuff going on with that team throughout most of their season. And, you know, to the best of my knowledge, I wrote about what was going on. It turned out we didn't even know the half of it when we saw Phil Jackson's book came out. But, and also what I realized is that I really fell in love with that Showtime team. You know, the first team I really remember watching and being excited about was Magic's rookie year when they won and they beat Philadelphia. And, you know, Magic, Kareem, James Worthy, Byron Scott, Michael Cooper, Norm Nixon those years, Kurt Rambis. And then, you know, that's what inspired me to get into journalism. I wanted to cover the Lakers. I wanted to be Chick Hearn and do the play-by-play for the Lakers. And then I realized, you know, as I got older, I realized, man, these guys aren't going to be around by the time, you know, if I'm fortunate enough to get that job. And, you know, of course, I was very lucky to get back to the LA Times at a young age, at age 26. And all those guys were gone, of course. It was the Shaq Kobe era, the start of that. You know, and it was just different. And I kind of rooted for those teams because you get to know them. You spend a lot of time around them. You get to know guys. You know, you want to see them be successful. If they're winning, they're in a good mood, so your job is easier. You know, and that team, that was Shaq, you know, Robert Horry, Rick Fox. Those are guys closer to my age. And then as those guys kind of moved on, you know, this younger group, I just don't feel that connection. You know, they're good guys. Luke Walton, you know, I've gotten to know Sasha Vujicic a little bit better. He's kind of fun to be around. Like I said, Lamar, you want to root for a guy like that. But, you know, it's not that connection. And I always say the difference is, you know, those other guys, I had their posters on my wall as a kid. You know, I don't have any posters. I'm not going to buy any of these guys' signature shoes. So it's kind of a disconnect. And I also feel like I got all I needed to get out of the Lakers. You know, they won 5 championships when I was growing up, when I was a young guy, when that, you know, determined my mood. When they lost in 84, I was in a funk, you know, the whole rest of the summer. And then when they won 85, 87, 88, especially 88, because that just kind of capped my youth. I was getting ready to go off to college, and I just wanted to see that one last championship.
You mean when you cheated?
What's that?
When you cheated in the last 3 seconds of Game 7,
you charged
the court.
You won't let that go, will you?
Charge the court. They were only down 3.
I was actually one of the guys that rushed the court right afterwards. So if you want to blame that on me, you know, for that, they should still be playing those 3 seconds, so they should be shooting free throws or something and clear the court. I was one of those guys that was
You guys,
on the court.
You should have all gotten playoff shares. You had as much to do with that win as anything. They were Isaiah was about to shoot a game-tying 3 and got body-blocked into the scorer's table
just
by
ran
Magic.
Him over.
But there was a near riot happening, so they had to just end the game.
Game over. Okay, I'll take the blame for that one, Bill.
When you covered those Shaq Kobe teams, as you said, there were some really interesting guys on those teams, close to your age, Rick Fox, Robert Horry, Derek Fisher. Like, these are like, you know, seem like good guys. Like, how hard was that for you to objectively cover those guys when you were probably friendly with them off the court, maybe getting drinks with them every once in a while? Was that like a weird line for you to cross?
No, because, you know, it's all right there in the box score, you know. I mean, if somebody shoots 2 for 12, you know, you can't say, man, he played a great game. It really wasn't that hard. And you know, Shaq was probably, you know, one of my favorites, but, you know, there were a couple times I ripped him, you know, and he just kind of took it in stride, you know.
Right.
The second time he goes, you know, that's strike two, you know, he comes up. I was trying to explain it before I could even get anything out of my mouth. He says, that's strike two, you're killing me. But, you know, he's a professional. He dealt with it. You know, Kobe was a little more sensitive to criticism. We basically didn't talk for most of 2004, going into 2005. You know, and then, you know, I just came up to him at start of training camp 2005, and I said, you know, we've had our differences. Let's put it behind us. And, you know, he said, fine. And it's funny because a lot of people out here think I have this anti-Kobe agenda, or, you know, you always get, oh, Kobe hater, writing nice things about Kobe. And you know, Kobe doesn't seem to have a problem. You know, he's answered my questions, giving me good questions. You know, he's not going to invite me over to his house, you know. But that's fine. You know, all I need to do is, you know, when I ask him questions, if he can answer them honestly, that's all we need. And we have that, you know, and we've been pretty good for, you know, the last 3-4 years.
Could you see the Shaq-Kobe thing, you know, could you see that coming down the highway, that whole thing deteriorating as it unfolded?
Yeah, the thing was, because this started really when they were still back at the Forum. You know, people don't realize that. People think it started later.
No, it goes back to like 99, right?
Yeah. You know, I remember, and one time, I remember trying to, I tried to arrange like a summit meeting, you know, just so like, I was like, guys, you know, can you guys just get in a room and talk this out?
Yeah.
And, you know, Shaq was okay with it, and Kobe's like, nah, I don't want to do it right now. And of course, you know, Shaq took that as a sign. You know, but there was always that tension. And then, you know, they were able to, you know, that even, you know, even when they're winning championships, you know, they're little pot shots that they take at each other kind of privately. So it was always there. And then, you know, once Kobe was able to do something about it with that free agency, you know, that opt-out clause he had in 2004, he exercised that. And, you know, people say, I don't think Kobe ever went to Jerry Buss and said, I demand Shaq goes or I'm not coming back. I don't think he ever put it in such explicit terms, but I think it was understood by the Lakers that Kobe wanted this team to himself. And, you know, that's why they traded. It's not a coincidence that they traded Shaq before the free agency deadline began.
And got rid of Phil Jackson. They did the two things.
You know, I mean, they go back and you know, there was that meeting on Super Bowl Sunday that year that between Kobe and Jerry Buss. And, you know, a few days later, the start of February, you know, all of a sudden the Lakers are announcing that they're not going to, you know, negotiate with Phil Jackson about a contract extension anymore. They're taking off the table. And they announced it. Not only did they stop, you know, they put out a press release, basically, and caught Phil off guard. And then, I mean, we were in Houston. It was right before the All-Star break. And we went and asked Kobe about it. And he said, you know, what do you think? Phil Jackson might not be next year. And he said, I don't care. Those are three words, and of course that just set off the whole entire All-Star weekend. Became all about Kobe versus Shaq and Phil, and you know the NBA was pretty mad because all the LA media was writing about that. And here you had all these All-Stars in town, and nobody cared. It was just Kobe, Shaq, and Phil, just like another Laker game.
Well, in Kobe's defense, and I hate to defend him because I really feel like he might be a sociopath, but after they won in 2000, the next three regular seasons, you could really make the case that Shaq was like in second gear. If he was a car that was in fifth gear, or that could go to fifth gear, he was in second gear for, you know, and really, especially the 2002 regular season, really egregiously mailed it in. And, you know, I think that probably ticked Kobe off because he's got to carry a lot of the load and you don't know if Shaq's showing up.
And that's the antithesis of the way Kobe operates.
Yes.
And, you know, they were such a bad match, you know, just their personalities were such a class. And I always said, I mean, you're right about that, Bill, and I always said they were both right and they were both wrong. I mean, Shaq was right that the offense should run through him. Phil Jackson agreed. I mean, you want to get the ball in the hands of the guy who's the highest percentage shooter in the league. Kobe was right in that Shaq should have been, you know, more dedicated, worked harder, you know, been a better free throw shooter. I mean, Kobe definitely deserved the ball in his hands in the fourth quarter because you don't want Shaq to get fouled and go to the line and break two free throws. But
I'm still sorting my feelings out on Shaq's career because part of me feels like he might have been the biggest waste of potential in NBA history. And then the other part feels like, you know, the guy, it was so unfun for him to play basketball because they really did change the rules for him. You were allowed to just hack him and club him and do whatever. Like, they called the game differently for him than any other player in the league. And I think after a while, you know, I just don't think it was as fun for him. And I think he liked making the money, and I think he liked playing in the playoffs. But just to be playing Sacramento in some random January game and have Brad Miller punching him in the back for four quarters, I think he just got tired of it.
No, I mean, his body took a tremendous amount of abuse, and, you know, he did have to put a lot of work just to stay on the court.
Yeah.
And, you know, taking painkillers that would upset his stomach, and, you know, he was really wary of that, especially after Alonzo Mourning had the kidney problems. You know, people suspected the painkillers he took could have been the source of that. So Shaq was really worried. So, you know, Shaq did put his body through a lot. You know, I mean, it's tough just moving that mass up and down the court every night. You know, I mean, you might not be too motivated, too, if you had to move 350 back and forth up and down the court. You know, you can say that about Shaq, but yeah, you can also say he's underachieved. Phil Jackson said it. I mean, Shaq should have more than one MVP award. He should have, you know, he should have had several rebounding titles, which he didn't. You know, he should have dominated and blocked shots. You know, I mean, you didn't see that from Shaq for his full career. I mean, when you go back, speaking of classic, you know, if you go back and watch, they show the Lakers against the Pacers sometimes in, you know, the 2000 series.
Yeah.
And just how active he was. You know, I mean, he was just dominant in the paint, jumping up, blocking shots, you know, sprinting down to the other end. I mean, it was completely different Shaq than we'd seen really before or after that. You know, that MVP season, that's when we saw Shaq maximize his potential. And the sad thing is that we didn't see more seasons like that. But
yeah, and I think he hit the apex, and then that was like, all right, I did it. And then that was it.
You know, and I think he realized, well, he also realized, okay, I can play at 60% for so long, and then, you know, we turn it on in the playoffs. You know, that's why it's the same. You can't call any of those Laker teams that three-peated a truly great team, because the 2000 team was great in the regular season and struggled and got pushed to the brink throughout the playoffs. The 2001 team was, you know, they struggled throughout the regular season and then just caught fire at the end and, you know, had one of the great playoff runs of all time. You know, they were a great playoff team. You can't call them one of the great teams because they didn't do it all year. And then, of course, 2002, they just kind of snuck by, and now, you know, the latest allegations, they had a little boost from the officials in the Sacramento series, too. So, you know, none of those teams was individually was one of the all-time great teams of NBA history.
Well, you could also make the case that they really, you know, they should have lost in 2000, the Blazers. That might have been the biggest collapse in the history of a Game 7. And then 2002, I still think the Kings were a better team. And the Game 6 officiating, you know, we didn't need Tim Donahue to tell us that that game was rigged. And then Game 7, Sacramento just missing
wide open shots. Sacramento choking, you know, Sacramento missing free throws. You know, I mean, they weren't up to it. And Doug Christie said later he was scared to death. So, you know, if your starting point guard or starting shooting guard is scared to death in a big game like that, you know, you don't deserve it. I mean, as bad as Game 6 was, and, you know, we've all seen it, and like you said, we don't need Donaghy to say that something was up. You know, they bottom line is they had a Game 7 on their home court, and they couldn't deliver. And they got plenty of trips to the free throw line in that game, and they couldn't cash them in.
And not just that, but how about Game 4? You know, the two rebounds before Robert Horry misses that three, they didn't get either of the rebounds.
Yeah.
So,
I mean,
you know.
There are some things there. You know, I think they got some breaks from the officials in Game 5. You know, they went back to Sacramento, and, you know, the ball was out of bounds. It should have been Lakers' ball, and it wasn't. So there's a lot of stuff going on in that series. But I think Game 7, nobody talks about the officiating. I thought Game 7 was a very well-officiated game. They let them play, and Sacramento had their chance. So I never weep for the Kings off that game.
I got to say, just wrapping up Shaq, my favorite Shaq game that I ever played was Game 4 in the 2004 Finals when, you know, Malone was playing on one leg, and everybody else was kind of stepping away from the moment. Kobe was gunning it up. And Shaq had, I think, like 36 points, 20 rebounds. And I remember Phil Jackson said after the game, we wasted, you know, one of the historic Shaquille O'Neal games. And you could kind of tell he knew the series was over, because if they weren't going to win with Shaq playing at that level, they weren't going to beat this team.
And he also knew that he couldn't get Shaq to play on that level night in, night out anymore. You know,
exactly.
And that was a real lament. And that game was just so bad because Kobe just wouldn't give Shaq the ball. You know, I mean, and that's when it became obvious to all the media members sitting there that, wow, you know, Kobe is going to win this. You know, if the Lakers are going to win, it's going to be because Kobe's the MVP. He's determined that. You could see it in Game 1, but it was most blatant in that Game 4. And, I mean, that's when the whole thing just got really ugly. And it was
I remember,
you know, just go ahead and lose and get this over. This is ugly.
I remember Shaq was like 16 for 20 and Kobe was like 8 for 26 or some crazy thing. Hey, I know you got to go. Give us your prediction for the rest of the series before you go.
Well, I think Game 3 showed that the – you know, this is really being played out the Celtics way. And, you know, if they could have gotten anything from Paul Pierce the first three quarters, and if Garnett, you know, could have been a little bit like Kevin Garnett, they could have won that game, even with the free throw discrepancy that was favoring the Lakers this time, even with Kobe Bryant looking more like Kobe. I mean, I thought coming in this was going to be about Kobe, but the Celtics defense has really been the star of this series. And, you know, defense rarely has nights off. You know, you don't have to worry about it on home and on the road. So I think the Celtics are in pretty good shape right now. So I think they probably take it back to Boston and win in Game 6.
Interesting. And one last thing. You couldn't have been happy as a Laker fan with that crowd in Game 3.
Pretty disappointed. But, you know, I knew it was going to be like that. That's one of the reasons I wanted the Lakers to win Game 2, just so that it would be more hyped up, you know, because, you know, Laker fans, let's say they're realistic. They're not the type that, you know, they're going to fall behind 2-0 or 3-0 in a series and you're going to see a bunch of signs that say, we believe, let's make history, we can do it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it gets 2-0. If it had been 3-0, then forget it. You know, I mean, there would have been hardly anybody. You watch how low the celebrity count would have been for Game 4. But I just think they realize, okay, down 2-0, you know, the odds aren't in our favor. And, you know, they just realize that, you know, why bother to really – you know, exert all that energy if it's not going to be there. I think they realize the Celtics are playing really well. This isn't going to be easy. Now, I'll say back in 2003 and 2004 when they were playing the Spurs, they got down 2-0, and the fans really did wheel the Lakers back into both of those series. You know, they lost it in 2003, and, of course, they won it in 2004. But I remember games 3 and 4 just being so tired after the games because the fans were using up so much energy. The Lakers had to play behind in games 3 and 4. And the fans just were really willing them to get back into the game, and they were just trying, and there was so much energy being produced and also just kind of being, you know, consumed in that building. And I was exhausted after both of those games. And that's when you realize the power of a crowd. You know, just even if I was just sitting there, you know, typing on my keyboard, you felt that energy and you become a part of it and it becomes a part of you. And you're just tired from all the energy that's being used in that building. So Laker fans can do it, you know, if they put their hearts into it. But, you know, I think more and more, this is also more of a celebrity crowd than ever. You know, the Lakers have become more of an event. And that's one thing I miss from the 80s in the Forum is, you know, they were just more genuine fans. And the fans at the top, who are your real fans, were closer to the court. There's some real fans up in the 300 section of Staples Center, but they're just so far from the court, they really can't have any impact on the game.
Yeah, I actually think the Lakers have a better crowd. I wrote this today. If it's a January game against Memphis, then a finals game in June, because the heavy hitters and the celebs are just going to descend on those good seats.
And I mean, I was looking at the loyal season ticket holder that I always see who sits near the media section, and she wasn't there game three. So I don't know. Maybe there's a reason, but maybe she just, you know, the money was too good to pass up. You know, and she was a great fan. She was such a good fan. She used to wear Kareem Rush jerseys. You know, she was like a dedicated and loyal Kareem Rush fan and had signs for him. And, she wasn't there for that game. So I think that's kind of an indication that, you know, the real fans aren't around and it's kind of, the Hollywood types are taking over.
Hey, what was Spike Lee doing rooting for the Lakers so vociferously last night?
I think it was more anti-Celtics than pro-Lakers, don't you think?
It seemed like he had something with Lamar Odom.
Lamar's a Brooklyn guy, you know. Yeah. So Lamar's a fellow New Yorker. There was one time out where Spike's like clapping. He's like, Lamar, come on, get with it.
I was just going to say, I saw the same thing. Lamar was almost like, it was like he was a tennis dad. Or Spike Lee was like a tennis dad imploring his son to really come through in the third set. And Lamar was just kind of nodding. Only you could see it in his eyes, like, "Hey Spike, don't you realize I'm having a panic attack here? Leave me alone."
I think he could have need some help there, you know, mouth to mouth resuscitation or something, get him going again.
Bad.
But I think Spike, I mean, obviously, you know, going back to do the right thing, Spike's got no love for the Celtics, so you know, I really think that was, you know, more anti. But I was talking to Spike, and he did use the pronoun "we" in talking about the Lakers, so I guess he's on board. Remember, Spike did that documentary on Kobe too. So, you know, maybe spending some time around the Lakers, you know, he's got a little bit of gold in him. He was wearing an orange and blue shirt, though, still.
The late Ralph Wiley is in heaven shaking his head right now.
Well, I got to say one thing, Bill, though. Don't you kind of feel like you sold out and you betrayed your Celtic roots? Living in L.A. now, you're surrounded.
No.
Your children were born here. They're going to grow up, you know, thinking Staples Center is a normal sports experience. Uh-uh. You know, you've sold out more than I have, I have to say.
Wow. That's a strong statement.
It's funny,
living here has made me hate the Lakers more, not less, like seeing those Laker flags and all that kind of stuff.
See, here's the thing. People say Laker fans are apathetic, and then they start finding Laker fans flags, and people criticize them for that. There's no greater display of affection you can show in Los Angeles than to pay tribute to someone with your car. The car is the ultimate symbol of Los Angeles. So when people start flying those Laker flags, I think they need to get a little credit for getting behind their team instead of, you know, people bashing them for being, you know, hopping on the trend.
I'm not criticizing him. I'm just saying I'd like to drive around in the place I live without seeing Laker flags. That's when I really go into over here. My son will be, by the time he's 5 and he's really starting to give a crap, I will be out of here because the thought of him ever going to the Staples Center and using the word "we" or wondering why he can't wear a Kobe jersey or whatever, that's when I'll have to go.
You really want to give up these beautiful winters and go back to that miserable, harsh Boston climate? You really want to give that up after 6 years out here?
I'm going to move away from L.A. and move somewhere else warm because you're right. Once you get a taste of the warm weather, it is so corrupting. It really is. I mean, even when I was back last weekend, and it was like, you know,
rain
99.
In the first 3 days. I didn't see the sun for the first 3 days.
It rained, and then all of a sudden it was 99, and I was thinking like, oh yeah, that's why I haven't moved back yet, because the weather sucks. Anyway, I'll let you go. I know we'll have you on again maybe after the finals, and we can have our little hash out. But until then, I will see you at the Staples.
All right, Bill. Good talking.
All right, thanks for coming on.
Sure.
Target to set off.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at Podcenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.